DNA protein, but it proved no good. Too much degradation. So we had to start from scratch, engineering our own PNA and testing it. Gray imagined the horrors and abuses involved with that research. Even Robert didn't sound proud, his voice growing hushed. But over time, we improved enough to produce the first stable child. Amanda's son. He nodded. But that stability ended up to be only temporary. And yet the cost of it was still so high. First Amanda's life, now my brother's. He pointed toward the door. And soon my grandnephew. It's too much. I must do what I can to preserve the rest of my family. They headed across the hall. Robert's melancholia settled back on his shoulders. I was a boy when I made my pact with that inner circle of the family, with the bloodline. I thought what we were doing here was so much larger than any individual life. Until it hit closer to home. Heavy is the head that wears the crown. And that weight and guilt would only grow when he assumed his brother's place at the White House, bringing the bloodline fully into power versus pulling the strings behind James Gant's back. Why have you told me all of this? Gray asked. Why did you bring me down here? So you might understand why a naive boy might succumb to such a cruelty, but an old man cannot suffer more loss. Robert turned to him. I brought you down here so that you could tell the world. Gray gaped, shocked. The loss of his brother must have been the proverbial straw that broke this camel's back. But didn't Robert order that assassination? Or was he as much a puppet on a string as President Gant? For now, Gray had a more important question if the man was folding up his tent. Why don't you come forward yourself? I've suffered enough. I will take those closest to me and vanish. To go where the lineage cannot find us. Robert headed away. I leave the rest on your shoulders. Gray followed behind him, passing the neighboring bank of mainframes in the other room. If Robert wanted to spill all, then he wanted to know everything. What's with the computer servers? He asked, sensing something important hidden there. Robert glanced disinterestedly in that direction. If this room is our heart, that's our brain, our memory. It holds our entire lineage, not just under the Gant name, but the others that were lost to the past. All the way back to our rumored beginning. Gray wanted to hear this. What beginning? The crescent and the moon. Our first symbol. Some of our earliest records connect those two symbols to the Canaanite god of human sacrifice. That's certainly fitting. That god was named Moloch, represented by the horns of a cow or the horns of a crescent moon. A closely related god was Refan, represented by the star. Some of our historians believe our roots go back to the time of Moses, that we were cast out by him for worshiping the crescent and the moon. He glanced back to the staff. There is a verse from the biblical Acts. You have lifted up the shrine of Moloch and the star of your god Refan, the idols you made to worship. Therefore I will send you into exile beyond Babylon. So you're saying you're the descendants of those exiled idol worshippers? I don't know. But the bloodline is ancient, and they still carry on some old Jewish traditions, like... Beyond the glass wall, the elevator doors opened with a buzz, drawing their attention forward. A familiar figure stepped out. The tall blonde woman strode purposefully forward. Those glacial eyes took in the situation with a single cold sweep. Stiff with surprise, Robert strode forward. Petra? Why, how are you down here? On the far side of the glass barrier, she stepped to the airlock, typed in a code on the outer door. Thick steel rods locked the room down. Robert rushed forward and tugged on the door handle. Apparently, someone had grown wise to his coming betrayal. Robert stopped tugging, realizing the truth. He called through the glass wall to her. You're of the lineage. Why was I never told? We are legion, she said, and not all are happy with your stewardship. When we lost the child, a useless thing, really, I contacted those whom I serve, reported what I found here. How you place grief over necessity, immediate family over the lineage. You tug and rip against the fabric that has lasted millennia. No more. You are of no further use to the lineage. But I've led for so many years. She smiled, a wicked look, as if scoffing at such a claim. When the body is strong, the head can be cut off. We will grow a new one and be stronger for it. You are to be set aside. This branch of the Gant clan is to be pruned away, including all the fruit born from it. We will purge the old to make way for the new, with no tears, only purpose. Robert's palm, which had been resting against the door, fell away. The purge will start here, in 10 minutes, at 3 o'clock, an appropriately powerful number. I've engaged the failsafe for both your labs and this Vault of Ages. This day, the lineage will shed its past and set its eyes only on the future. Immortality is within grasp, ultimate power at our doorstep. Petra bowed, oddly respectful. Those you love will not suffer, she said, her eyes fixing at Robert. Even those you do not believe we know about. Robert lunged forward and pounded, his voice breaking. Stop! She retreated to the elevator, facing them, though her gaze stared elsewhere. They were already forgotten. Gray waited for the doors to close, then turned to Robert. Looks like you're out of a job. He tilted his cuffed wrists toward the man. How about we get these off? Robert looked both angry and grief-stricken at the same time. Been there, Gray thought. As the man undid his cuffs, Gray asked the question he was afraid to know the answer to. What's this failsafe? Robert's face went grave. A thermobaric bomb. One will incinerate the vaults down here, but over at the lab... He shook his head, looking sick. What's gonna happen at the lab? 2:51 p.m. The evacuation alarms echoed across the facility as red warning lights flashed, turning the world shades of crimson. Sinkhole, Fielding explained as he shoved papers into a briefcase. What? Edward asked, sticking close to the man. Others fled in various directions, grabbing what they could. A majority of the complex sits above a dry underground lake. Miners at the turn of the century discovered the lake below, fed by an underground river. Later, engineers capped that river during construction, built scaffolding to support the lab over the pit. We're not in an underground lab. He snapped his briefcase closed with a note of finality. We're on a massive suspension bridge over a yawning pit, and they're about to blow out that suspension. He moved to his workstation. It will create a 20-acre-wide sinkhole that will flood as that main river is unplugged. And a new lake will be born over our graves if we don't get clear of here. Edward rushed the man. Then let's bloody well go. I'm not going to lose my research, or my work. Fielding tapped at a screen. This will be their ultimate test. What are you doing? Giving them a fighting chance. Fielding leaned to a microphone as green lights flashed down row after row of pod designations. He spoke the final command order, transmitted to all of his army. Survive! Beneath Edward's feet, a low rumble rose. He backed toward the door. What was Fielding thinking, unleashing that horde now? Just the generators powering up, Fielding assured him, picking up his briefcase. The activation sequence in warm-up mode takes 8 minutes. We'll be far away by then. Still, Edward hurried to the door. He turned to see something leap from the work table and latch onto Fielding's back, landing square between his shoulder blades. It was one of his new hexapods. In the excitement, the researcher had forgotten he'd activated this one earlier, left it on standby mode while he tinkered. Fielding screamed and struggled to reach the beast, but its ice-pick-thin legs, sharpened to surgical points, punctured deep, latching on firmly. Edward backed toward the door. Fielding had explained about this newest pod, a nester. Its bulbous body housed a swarm of smaller robots. Fielding backed toward him. "Get it off! Get it off!" Edward retreated, unable to tear his gaze away. Now, latched against his back, the pregnant creature vomited a stream of smaller bots from its swollen abdomen. They spread like fire ants, racing down his back, up his neck, over his shoulders, along his chest and limbs. "No! No! No!" Fielding cried, spinning in a circle, knowing what was coming. Then, as if on cue, the march of the bots all stopped at once and began drilling into his flesh. The animal howl of pain finally broke through Edward's shocked paralysis. He twisted away. He knew what they were drilling for. The other larger pods were attuned to body heat. These smaller ones were attracted to the sound of beating hearts. They would drill and drill until that beat was finally silenced. But from the endless howling that chased Edward toward the surface, it took a long time. 2:52 p.m. As minutes ticked down, Gray lay on his side, rubbing his chafed wrists. The Secretary of State of the United States knelt over his head, picking a plug of C4 out of his ear canal, using a 3,000-year-old sliver of Egyptian bone, a funerary object stolen from one of the cabinets. "That looks like most of it," Robert said. "Good." He didn't want to be down here when the thermobaric weapon exploded. Fuel air bombs created blast waves that rivaled nuclear bombs and ignited oxygen to 5,000 degrees. He rolled to his rear end and set to work digging out the earpiece and blasting cap. He used a pair of tweezers to poke, prod, and pull the device free. It felt like yanking a walnut out, leaving his ear ringing. "Got it." He hurried and gathered everything together. The barrier was layered tempered glass, too thick to break through with anything in the room. He stuck the reassembled explosive charge to the glass wall to the left of the airlock door. He centered it in the middle of the etched symbol of the genetic cross. "Get back," he warned. Gray carried the transmitter that Robert had given him. They found shelter behind a case, and Gray pressed the button. In the enclosed space, the blast felt like two anvils striking the sides of his head. He coughed against the smoke, reeking of burned tar, and hurried Robert to his feet. He waved a hand in front of his face and saw the tempered glass barrier had shattered to a bluish-white crumble. With his ears deafened, he had to yell to hear his own voice. "Out!" Gray cast one last regretful glance behind him at the vast wealth of history about to be destroyed. His eyes settled on that staff, the Bacolisa, Staff of Christ, but it was sealed behind bulletproof glass. He didn't have the time or force of strength to rescue it. With a heavy heart, he had to abandon it. Robert stood on shaky feet, dazed by the blast, but he allowed himself to be dragged along. It took his palm print and code to call the elevator back down. As they waited, Robert stared toward the smoky museum. "Maybe it's better I should die," Robert said. "After what I did..." Gray had to keep the man motivated and moving. "Robert, I need to share something with you. Your brother, Jimmy, and his daughter, Amanda." "What about them?" Robert asked, with a hitch in his voice. "They're both still alive." Robert flinched, turning sharply to him. "What?" As the elevator arrived and the doors opened, Gray gave him a thumbnail sketch of the story. "And then there's Amanda's son to think about," Gray said. "You mentioned he was here." Robert stared sullenly as the cage rose. "He was, but he was kidnapped again." This time, Gray jerked his head in the man's direction. Robert explained. "By another captive. A medical doctor, a woman investigating our fertility clinic." Gray pushed his shoulder and stared him hard in the face. "Lisa Cummings? You know her? Was there another woman with her?" "Yes, they're both at the lab complex with my grandnephew. But it's 10 miles away. We can't even get word there in time. Grace swore, his heart clutching. He pushed Robert against the wall harder than he had meant to. What about the woman I was captured with? Seishan. Was she taken to that damn lab, too? Robert's brows pinched at Gray's reaction. No, he said slowly. We kept her here. As the elevator stopped at the top, the heavy vault door took forever to swing open. Gray had to restrain himself from pounding his fists against it, both in his anxiety to get to Seishan and in frustration that he could do nothing to help Lisa and Kat. Finally, the thick door opened enough for Gray and Robert to exit and climb out of the massive wine barrel and back into the main cellar. He hurried, not knowing if the thermobaric weapon was of sufficient size to burn through the cellars too, or would it take down the whole castle. Even Robert was equally clueless. Gray didn't want to be here to find out. Where's Seishan? He asked, ready to run ahead. You'll get lost. Robert rushed alongside him, keeping up. I'll show you, but what? After Petra left us trapped. Robert looked both scared and apologetic. I think she was headed to kill her. Chapter 39. July 4th, 2:52 p.m. Airborne over the Blue Ridge Mountains. 7 minutes out, the pilot reported from the cockpit. Painter shared the cargo hold of USAF C-41A, a turboprop-powered medium transport plane. They had screamed down from D.C. in a military jet, then transferred to this smaller craft, which was better suited for infiltration and exfiltration of troops, meaning it was basically a cockpit in cargo space. His team was the cargo. Tucker readied Kane in his tandem harness for the drop. Kowalski and Monk checked each other's gear. Painter was already suited up and sat with his laptop open and hooked to a satellite uplink, getting a live feed of the Gant estate and targeting movement on the ground to aid in their daytime penetration of the lodge. He had Jason Carter in his ear. Director, I'm patching new feed. We picked up movement a little over 10 miles from the mansion. We didn't get this sooner with all eyes on the lodge, but you'd better see this. The image on his screen swung away from the lodge toward the Continental Divide, a rugged chunk of territory. Who was way out there? A small figure could be seen standing next to a waterfall, holding a package. No, a child. The view toggled closer and closer until there could be no doubt. Lisa, Painter said. And I believe the other's Kat, sir, about a quarter mile southeast. As the image swooped in that direction, Painter waved Monk over. You should see this. By the time the man arrived, Jason showed a blurry video of a woman running through the woods. Details were hard to pick out between the trees. What was evident was that she was headed straight for a sheer cliff drop. That's my wife, Monk said, scared but tightly in control. Never looking where she's going. Jason spoke again. I've got movement on the ground behind her, but I can't pick up any details. The pilot called from up front. We're 2 minutes out from the no-fly demarcation. I'm going to start angling around to get us skirting along its edge. Painter passed his laptop to Monk and crossed to the cockpit. New plans, he instructed. We're going straight in. Sir, we don't have the proper clearance. Take it up with the president when we get back, Painter said. You take us in low and straight. Follow the Continental Divide. Once we cross into the no-fly zone, you open up the rear ramp for us to bail out. Painter swung back around. Monk raised an eyebrow. How come my wife doesn't have any hair? Jason spoke in Painter's ear, a scary urgency to his tone. How long until you're on the ground? We bail out in 6. On the ground, 7 or 8. That'll be too late. 2:53 p.m. Blue Ridge Mountains. Kat sprinted for the goal line. She had lost her slippers, her toes dug for purchase in the soft loam and slippery spruce needles. Rocks, pine cones, and acorns tore at her soles, but she ignored the pain. She flew over obstacles with long-legged leaps, happy for the obstruction of a log or jagged outcropping as it slowed her pursuers. The front edge of the hunters was only yards behind. She had dispatched three, but over a dozen still remained, working in tandem. The shield and pipe were futile against their numbers, especially as this group was not uniform. She identified at least four variants among them, each with specialized functions. Crawlers she dealt with during the first wave. Leapers could spring like frogs when close enough and slash out, or worse yet, latch on. Spinners could accelerate at blistering paces for short bursts, becoming flying saw blades. The last group was still unknown, trundling more at the rear, slower than the others, looking like steel helmets with legs. She hadn't come through unscathed. The first spinner caught her by surprise, whizzing past, slicing a gash in her calf. Blood poured down her ankle. She was ready for the second, striking out with her pipe, swinging for the bleachers. The spinner ended up embedding its whirring self into the trunk of an oak, becoming stuck. Ahead, the tree line broke apart, and sunlight beckoned. The forest ended at a cliff. She searched and spotted what she needed, angling to the left. A telltale explosive squeak warned her. She lashed out with her shield, swiping low, as a leaper sprang at her. With a satisfying clang, she struck it and sent it cartwheeling away. She sped faster, making her pursuers do the same, but also gaining a little space. As she ran, she plucked at the drawstring of her gown, loosening it. Once done, she flung her pipe and shield at the base of a maple tree ahead. They clattered close enough. As she ran the final steps toward the cliff's edge, she ripped the gown over her head, which blinded her for a frightening moment. She balled up the sweaty, hot garment. Reaching the cliff, still sprinting, she leaped up, threw the ball of clothes over the edge. She caught a low branch. Below her, the front guards of the horde went racing over the edge to their doom 3 stories below. Leapers, crawlers, and one lonely spinner, who in a last-ditch effort whizzed in a spectacular arc off the cliff and chased after the hot bundle of clothes. Not everyone went over, but confusion reigned in the remaining half. She dropped back to the ground long enough to shove her shield on her forearm and tuck the pipe through her panties, like a sword in a scabbard. She leaped again to the same branch and hauled herself atop it with a heave of her legs. The hunter stirred below, contemplating their next move. A shout drew her attention, barely discernible above the roar of a waterfall a couple of 100 yards to her right. She searched, following the curve of the cliff to where a small river tumbled over its edge to crash below. It was in those misty lower levels that she spotted a thin shape waving her whole arm. Lisa stood on a plateau on the far side of the waterfall. Her friend was trapped by the sheer cliffs behind her and the surging river below. And she wasn't trapped alone. Lisa held a baby in her arms. Cat waved back, then froze. Lisa's shout had drawn more than her attention. Behind her friend, at the top of the cliff, sunlight glinted off a creature the size of a small lion. It leaned over the edge like a steel gargoyle. Cat! Lisa shouted, still waving, further drawing its attention with all of her noise and motion. Lisa, stop moving! Cat yelled back. Lisa shook her head and cupped her ear. The roar of the neighboring falls must have deafened her. Cat struggled with how to communicate to Lisa, how to pantomime what needed to be done. I was never good at charades. Before Cat could even begin, the creature started climbing down the cliff face. 2:55 p.m. Lisa floated on her toes, so happy to see Cat safe. Her friend's dramatic appearance, leaping half-naked into a tree, accompanied by a shower of silvery hunters, brought such joy and hope. The thunder of the falls stripped whatever words Cat had tried to share, but her friend must have understood and began motioning dramatically. An arm pointed to the waterfall, then mimicked taking a shower. Lisa didn't understand and shook her head. Cradled in her arms, the baby was growing restless, likely from the constant roaring of the falls. A rock pinged off the ledge that was her prison. Cat repeated the gesture, adjusting it slightly. After pointing to the waterfall, she waved her fingers in front of her face. Lisa stared and saw that a part of the plateau tucked behind the waterfall. but that shelf still roiled with mist, spray, and sudden dowsings as the currents above shifted. Finally, Cat pointed straight up, using her whole arm. Another chunk of rock fell off of the cliff face and struck her landing. A trickle of terror ran up her back as she suddenly sensed something staring at her. She turned and looked at the cliff. Halfway up hung a monstrosity of steel plate, razor claw, and titanium fangs. She screamed, backing several steps, coming close to throwing herself off the cliff and into the river below. The noise and motion drew a swivel of its sleek head, revealing faceted black eyes, sensors, staring back at her. She froze and cut off her scream, knowing noise must attract it. Then the baby began to wail. 2:56 p.m. Cat watched helplessly as the steel gargoyle climbed down from its perch, digging hooked claws into crevices, lowering itself limb by limb, crack by crack, with the inevitability of a well-wound watch. "Come on, Lisa, remember what I showed you." A clack and whirring at the foot of the maple reminded her of her own predicament. The five helmeted pods now circled the tree, sitting stationary. Simultaneously, their domed backs split into halves and folded back, revealing four smaller robots inside. They were flat and square in shape, with tiny propellers at each corner. In unison, the entire aerial fleet rose from their ground-based carriers, lifting in eerie formation, perfectly tuned to one another. Then, upon some silent cue, the pack rose, whipping and winding up the tree in a blurring pattern, stripping leaves and small twigs with their scalpel-sharp, whirring blades. They climbed the tree like a deadly tornado of daggers. She lifted shield and pipe. A loud clank drew her attention momentarily back across the waterfall to Lisa's perch. The monster must have lost its footing and fell. It righted itself, flipping back to its sharp claws on the plateau. Cat searched, but Lisa was gone. 2:57 p.m. The sudden shock of the icy water stole Lisa's breath. She shielded the squalling child as best she could, hunching over him, drawing him close to her bosom for the warmth of her body heat. She edged as far back along that ledge of rock behind the waterfall as she could manage, without being pummeled off her perch. After the first initial shock, she figured out Cat's message. In fact, it was those black eyes of the steel bear, cold, alien sensors taking in the world, that allowed her to interpret her friend's pantomime. The beast had to use some method to hunt, to understand its surroundings. The shelter of the waterfall offered a way to blind those sensors. The rippling cascade would challenge any motion detectors. The cold would mask her body heat. The roar would deafen and confound its sense of hearing. So she risked hypothermia, unfortunately more of a threat to the child than to her, to keep them hidden. But would it work? 3/4 of the way down the wall, the creature fell, or leaped. It landed hard, its large bulk at the mercy of gravity, but afterward there remained an undeniable grace to its movement as it stalked toward her hiding place. It must have watched her come this way, but could it tell she was still here? It knuckled forward on daggers curled back like the claws of a three-toed sloth. It stalked with a thoughtful and determined placement of each leg, like a house cat hunting a mouse. Lisa shifted even deeper under the falls, letting the water fully envelop her. The baby cried against her soaked chest, but the roar of the falls drowned any wails away. The sloth-like automaton pushed under the falls, pivoting its massive head, opening its huge steel jaws, revealing a maw of titanium death, a bear trap with legs. Through the heavy chute of water, black eyes stared back at her, seeming to see her, but who knew what it truly saw? And still it came, pushing forward. 2:58 p.m. Airborne over Blue Ridge Mountains. In the cargo hold of the C-41A transport plane, Painter kept glued to the satellite feed on his laptop. He pressed shoulder to shoulder with Monk, who watched as fervently. Both their women were in danger, and for the moment there was nothing either man could do but watch. The rear ramp was already open, awaiting their bailout. But they weren't in position yet. "How much longer?" Painter hollered.
2 minutes out,"
the pilot answered, screaming to be heard above the roar of the wind through the open bay doors. Painter stared at the screen, knowing it would be the longest 2 minutes of his life. Chapter 40. July 4th, 2:58 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Blue Ridge Mountains. Seishan stood in the middle of her richly appointed prison cell. A soft scuffling alerted her a minute ago that someone was outside in the hall, struggling with the door. Apparently, they didn't have the code for the electronic deadbolt. The oddness drew her out of the chair by the window. The difficulty with the lock, was that good, bad, or inconsequential? She stepped closer, passing the room's small fireplace, when half the door and a chunk of the wall exploded before her, throwing her back. She rolled across the ancient Turkish rug and struck the foot of her bed. Through the smoke and the ruin, the upper torso of the guard could be seen out in the hallway on the floor, neck twisted impossibly. Not from the bomb. Someone had quietly dispatched him. With her ears ringing, Seishan watched the silent entry of the source of all that death and destruction. The long-legged woman stepped through the wreckage of the door. She carried a pistol in her hand and a look of stern purposefulness on her face. Seishan was more worried about the gun. She needed that gun. She shifted smoothly into a crouch. Seishan knew this woman. It was the doctor's research partner back in Dubai, Petra, the one who had drugged Gray back on the boat. Still shell-shocked, Seishan missed the woman's first few words before her hearing returned.
"Such promise," Petra said. "You were of the lineage, of our blood. You were being groomed for so much more."
Seishan had difficulty making sense of her statements. Back on the boat in Dubai, she had suspected this woman had been raised as she had. The muscular surety of her movements, the hard glint of perpetual vigilance, the cold calculation to her countenance. It took a monster to recognize a monster. The woman's words echoed in her head. Groomed for so much more. Was this what she would have become? A worse fear rose from the marrow of her bones. Am I that already? Seishan remained crouched, but she shifted her left leg an inch forward for better balance, for better power. The woman noted this. She repositioned her weapon and shifted to the side, ruining Seishan's preparation, reaching the perfect spot where it would be awkward for Seishan to attack. They stared each other down.
"When you turned traitor against us," Petra said, "you became a corrupted thing, a broken vessel, leaving the purity of the lineage. For what? For the love of a man?"
Seishan stiffened, the words poking a raw nerve. Petra must have sensed her reaction, her words hard with disdain.
"Such a piteous waste. Better you die like a dog than live like one."
Petra fired. But Seishan was already moving as the muscles in her opponent's forearm tightened in anticipation of the recoil. The bullet still burned a hot line across her flank as she twisted to the side, offering less of a target. She hit Petra in the shins with her shoulder, flipping the woman high. Seishan rolled and twisted, ready to go for the woman's weapon. But Petra never lost it. She landed on a knee, one leg back, still facing Seishan, her gun still pointed at her face. At that moment, Seishan knew two things. She's better than me, and the worse for it. She closed her eyes and pictured one face, one regret, as the pistol fired again and again at her. And a ghostly wind rushed past her. The rounds burned into Robert's chest as he threw himself between the woman and the weapon, blocking her fully with his broad body, a wall before a flower. The pain was a small thing against the enormity of what might be lost if he failed. Then Gray was there, sliding into the room with the automatic rifle from the dead guard in the hallway. He fired on full auto, blasting Petra back,
and he never stopped shooting until the clip emptied. Only then did he whip around.
Seishan,
Gray said, sliding to her side. Robert knew the man loved her, saw it in his eyes. He had loved a woman as much as that once, too. He met her while he was a young ambassador to Southeast Asia. He pictured her sweet face aglow under the moonlight in the garden, lost in the drift of cherry blossoms, her lips as soft as the whispery song of thrushes in the branches and the tinkle of a fountain. But it was always the emerald of her eyes he returned to, the intensity reflecting all inside her, never dimming. Her love, a reflection of his own, was forever frozen in jade. He ran the edge of his thumb along her cheekbone, letting his adoration shine. And at that moment, time shifted. But not those eyes. Never those eyes. He didn't know he had fallen into Seishan's arms. His hand was raised, touching gently, something forever forbidden him. Knowing then, it was right he die here. In his daughter's arms. Seishan held the man, not understanding, baffled by the sudden tears in her eyes. The barrage of bullets had knocked him back into her arms. She caught him, the man who had cast aside his life for her, the same man who had imprisoned her. Why? He stared up silently at her as if drinking her in, raising a hand to touch her cheek. And strangely still, she let him, seeing something in his eyes that she couldn't deny. Gray returned to her side, dropping next to her. The assassin was dead. The woman had a name, but those five letters held no meaning. In the end, she was nameless, just purpose in human form. Seishan stared at the bloody ruin, then turned away again, suddenly freer. I will not be you, and I'm stronger for it. Gray slipped an arm around her. Seishan. And there was the simple answer. She had a name, spoken by someone who gave it weight, depth, meaning, and substance. But in that moment, she learned she had another name, one forever unknown. The man dying in her arms told her. His arm dropped, too weak now, his breath a whisper.
You have your mother's eyes.
Trembling fingers found hers, perhaps sensing her shock.
I tried to protect you, to hide you, to keep you from them.
His eyes never left her face.
But after your mother was taken, it took so long to find you. When I did, I couldn't let you go. Selfish. But to acknowledge you would have been your death. So I hid you in plain sight within the guild, close but forever apart. I was blind, naive to the cruelties that would be inflicted on you, would be asked of you later. I'm sorry.
Seishan didn't know how to respond, drawn into the past, remembering that night, hiding under the bed, terror-stricken, as her mother was dragged away. Fingers squeezed one last time, trying to hold on. Seishan stared down at him, at the impossibility of her father.
Your mother, he said,
his eyes wide with the urgency of those last words, the last gasp of meaning all sought during that final breath.
Escaped. Still alive after... Don't know where...
With his message out, he sagged, hollowed out by his escaping life, relaxing into death. His eyes drifted closed. His last words were oddly clear and sad.
No father should lose a daughter.
With that, he was gone. Gray pulled Seishan to him, holding her as she held her father. Then the world quaked, booming with the thunder of gods. Chapter 41. July 4th, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Blue Ridge Mountains. Painter hovered high as the world exploded below. Seconds earlier, his parachute canopy had burst wide, becoming a wing of fabric overhead, jolting him in his harness. Then the entire plateau bulged upward, reaching toward him with a heavy bass note of buried warheads. His teammates hung in the air to either side. Monk and Kowalski headed toward Kat's position at the cliff's edge. Tucker was several yards lower, skimming toward Lisa's ledge beside the waterfall. He carried Kane strapped to his chest in a tandem harness. Between Painter's legs, the entire landscape fell away, shattering apart, vanishing down into a growling pit of churning rock, fire, and steam. Entire sections of forest dropped into the hellish gorge. Smoke and rock dust blasted upward, swallowing his group. Twisting thermals wreaked havoc. Painter's chute swung wildly and sailed higher on a column of superheated air. Choking, Painter held his breath and covered his face with an arm, protecting his eyes. He fought the chute's toggles to stabilize his spin, losing sight of the others. He had experienced this level of destruction once before. He recognized the superheated signature of thermobaric weapons, only never on a scale strong enough to raise a significant chunk of the Earth's crust. The initial plume whirled higher, dragging the worst of the smoke and superheated air away, clearing a glimpse to the ongoing destruction. Below, a gateway to hell opened, a gaping, steaming hole, breathing fire and stinking of brimstone. At its edges, more of the landscape succumbed. Hillsides slid, dragging trees and boulders. Rivers and creeks poured down that black throat, only to belch back out as clouds of steam. Down deeper, a heavy flow flooded the giant pit, boiling and stirring everything into a toxic soup. Painter stabilized his chute, sweeping out, catching the glimpse of twisted steel beams and honeycombed sections of concrete, fossilized hallmarks of man-made construction. The remains of a massive subterranean base. Even these structures slowly vanished into the roiling mire at the bottom. Painter tore his gaze away, searching around him. The three other parachutes floated lower, managing the thermals better than he did. The curve of the cliff that was their destination remained intact, taller now, looming over that steaming sinkhole.
"Going for Cat," Monk reported.
"Crap in my pants!"
That was Kowalski. The pair dropped fast toward Cat's position, angling into as much of a glide as possible, still fighting the unpredictable thermals. If they missed the cliff's edge, they would go plummeting into the churning maw below. Painter twisted in his harness, spotted Tucker and Kane soaring toward Lisa. Her ledge remained intact, little else. The waterfall still fell alongside it, but there was no river below to catch it. The 30-foot falls had become a 300-foot plunge into smoky darkness. Farther away, a massive section of the cliff face broke away and slid, like a calving glacier, into the depths of the sinkhole. Lisa's ridge looked like it might fall at any time. Pieces were already chipping and cracking under it. But at the moment, that wasn't her biggest danger. The shifting waterfall had driven her out of hiding and into the view of the monster sharing her perch. The two crouched on opposite ends of the plateau.
"Heading down to her!"
Tucker radioed.
"Captain Wayne, go topside. Set a rope."
"Negative. I'm past the point of no return. Too low, not enough lift to carry me to that edge. The only drop zone for me is that ledge of rock."
He might be lying, playing hero, but Painter was indeed higher. He had a better chance of reaching the top of the cliff, and someone had to secure the lines to reach the ledge below.
"Understood," Painter radioed back,
though it killed him to head away from Lisa.
"Going topside."
He pulled his toggle with a sweaty hand and swept to the right, angling for the edge, knowing time was running short. As he turned, he caught a glimpse of the lodge, cloaked in smoke, its heart glowing with hellfire. The crack of a pistol drew his attention down. Tucker dove toward the ledge, going in fast, firing his pistol at the beast. Then, Painter was over the cliff's edge, and he lost sight of the battle, pitting man against machine. 3:03 p.m. Tucker needed room. The ledge was the size of a basketball court, with Lisa on one end and the bear-sized beast on the other. Drawn by his approach, the creature dashed into his path, knuckling on its curved claws. It skidded sideways, its large obsidian glass eyes staring up at him. He fired, but the round pinged harmlessly off its hardened armor. Still, the shots drove the beast back to its side, long enough for Tucker to haul on both of his toggles, flare his chute, and break his plummet to a smooth but heavy landing. His heels hit first, then toes, and he rolled to his knees. He pulled two releases at the same time. The first unhooked his chute, which went wafting against the cliff, then skimming away, dragging lines and harness. The second freed Kane. His partner dropped to his paws, a ridge of hackles raised like a mohawk down his back. Tucker pulled out a second pistol. He held it flat toward Lisa, warning her to stay back. The beast crouched low, perfectly motionless, studying and assessing its new prey. But that wouldn't last long. Lisa whispered to him, her eyes wide with fear, but not for her safety. Baby's going into shock. He crept back to her, signaling Kane to stand guard. Dog and machine faced each other, mirroring each other's wary stance. Lisa was soaked from the waterfall, the baby hung in wet swaddling, not making a sound, tinged bluish. Tucker swore to himself, I'm not losing this baby again. A scrabble of steel on rock sounded as the monster charged. Sparks lit each step as steel clashed with rock. It barreled straight at them. Tucker raised his pistol, recognizing how useless it had been before, knowing that nothing could stop it, but he was ready to defend with his life. He wasn't the only one. Kane watches it come, not moving. It smells of oil, grease, and lightning, but he recognizes a hunter, because he is one too. It sees the world as he does. It shifts to the wind, scenting. It turns to the rasp of voice and step. Its black eyes twitch to the flutter of fabric and tangled line. It also thinks, only moving when ready, judging the weakest. Like now. It comes for him, because it is still young, new to the world, a pup. Kane meets its charge with a bark and a feint, dodging to the side of its steel flank. He makes it spin and come after him. It is fast, powerful, but in the end, it is young. He is not. He races on pads that have run across hot sands, hard tarmac, powdery snow, gravel roads, and slippery ice. He had studied the hunter, watched it skid on bright sparks. Kane! The other shouts. He hears the timbre of fear, not command. So Kane runs straight for the edge, for the long fall to sharp rock. The other thunders after him, hulking, legs crashing steel into stone. He reaches the edge and stops fast, pads grinding to pain on the coarse path, then twists, because he knows he can. He is not young. This is stone. He whips to the side with a surge of his legs. The other is young. Stone is its ice, something it has not learned. Kane spins on his hind legs and watches the creature skid past him, leaving a trail of sparks, and goes over the edge, because it had not learned, and now never will. Tucker dropped to a knee as Kane came running back. He hugged the dog proudly, knowing he had saved their lives. Bullets wouldn't have stopped that charge of purposeful steel, not in time to keep it from reaching them, slaughtering them. And neither Tucker nor Lisa were wily enough to use the creature's rudimentary instincts against it, nor agile enough to lure it to its death. Still, Kane shoved his head between Tucker's legs, a familiar request for reassurance. It's okay, boy. You did good. But his tail stayed down. Tucker knew dogs lived emotional lives as rich as most people. Different, alien in many ways, but still they experienced their world deeply. Tucker sensed what Kane was feeling. They knew each other beyond hand signals and commands. Remorse and regret. Kane was not happy to send that creature to its death. You had to do it, Tucker said. Kane knew that too, but his tail stayed down. 3:06 p.m. Edward Blake hated the train service here. Buried in a dark tunnel, lit only by the stray battery-powered emergency lamp, he sat on a bench seat in the enclosed single-car tram with a dozen other members of the lab complex staff and guards. The distant boom of the explosion had long faded away, but not the damage. The electricity had gone out at the same time, and the train had slowed to a stop. One of the passengers, wearing a guard uniform, checked the odometer. They had traveled 9 miles, a mile short of the depot at the lodge. Edward closed his eyes and rubbed his temples.
"We should just walk," someone suggested.
"What if the electricity comes back on?"
"Then don't step on the rails. We're safer here."
"Oh, shut the bloody hell up."
"Quiet," another shouted from the back of the car, echoing his sentiment.
Finally, someone with sense.
"Listen," the same man said. Then Edward heard it too. A low rumble, getting steadily louder, like another train was hurtling down the tunnel intended to rear-end them. But as it got louder, he heard a telltale gurgle.
Water.
He stood, along with everyone in the tram, and moved to the back of the car. The tunnel stretched out into darkness, measured by the small red emergency lamps every 50 yards. Then they all saw the monster, eating one light after the other, far down the passage. A flood surged toward them. Most started screaming. One man dashed out of the door, intending to outrun the flood.
"Fool."
Edward held a hand to his throat and sank back to his seat. He didn't want to watch. After years of working at an underwater lab in Dubai, he would drown here in the middle of the bloody mountains, thousands of feet above sea level. Though he didn't watch the surge swallowing light after light, counting down the last seconds of his life, he still heard death coming for him. A couple of people on the floor, praying.
Even bloodier fools.
After all that went on at that lab, God was surely deaf to their pleas for salvation. The rumble grew to a thunderous crescendo. Then the wall of water struck the back of the tram. The impact threw them all to the rear of the car and sent the tram rolling down the track, bobbling hard, but moving. People gained their feet, clutching for handholds. Water sprayed through cracks and seams at the back, but the sealed car was like a bullet in a gun barrel, being shot down the tunnel. No one spoke, all fearing to express hope. Even the prayers had stopped, the supplicants already forsaking their God. Someone at the front called back, yelling to be heard above the roaring beast that propelled them forward.
"Sellers ahead! I see lights!"
The secret depot. They were going too fast.
"Is there a manual brake?" he called out.
The guard rushed forward.
"Yes!"
Edward joined him as the end of the tunnel hurtled toward them. He saw there were indeed lights ahead, a fiery, blazing conflagration. The guard abandoned the brake and sat down. Edward did too. Moments later, the car shot into the heart of the inferno. Water spread outward through the labyrinthine cellar complex, blasting into steam. Fires blazed all around. Their little pocket of air was only useful to fill their lungs for screaming, which they did, as they slowly burned. 3:08 p.m. Kat clutched her husband's neck, carried in his arms. Blood flowed from scores of tiny lacerations, shallow and deep, wounds from her battle with the helmeted pod's flying horde. She had beaten them back as Monk and Kowalski swept in, shedding their chutes and rolling to her aid. She half fell out of the tree into Monk's arms. He had grabbed the last few flyers out of the air with his prosthetic hand. The tough synthetic skin and crushing grip made short work of them. She could have used one of those and told him so. His answer?
"You ain't seen nothing yet."
Now they fled together through the woods, chased by scores of the pods, creatures of every ilk. The loss of blood, along with the exhaustion of her battle, turned the world into a hazy, fluttering view, shadowed at the corners. Kowalski fired behind them, keeping the worst at bay, but there were too many. Like ants boiling out of a flooded nest, the Legion came crawling, leaping, spinning, burrowing, flying away from the destruction behind them.
"There!" Monk called to Kowalski as they broke into a wide meadow.
A steep-sided outcropping of granite offered a vantage from which to make a stand. They fled toward it. From her perch in her husband's arms, she watched the hunters break out of the woods on all sides, converging and sweeping toward them across the grasses. Hundreds of them. Monk sped faster, Kowalski at his side. They reached the outcropping and manhandled her to the top, then joined her. As they huddled, the hunters came surging up to the rocky island, scrambling over one another to reach them, climbing higher, using their living brethren to form a growing bridge. The attack also came from the air. Clouds of flyers burst high out of the grasses, like a startled flock of crows. They swept in an organized, beautiful spiral, gathering others to them, swelling their ranks before the final assault. They're learning fast. A spinner